Hi, this is Gil Wirth from the OAM Podcast Network in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm here with Michael Cook, the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of Southern Sun Asset Management. Southern Sun is a public equity investment manager based in Memphis, Tennessee, and was founded by Mr. Cook in 1989. The firm manages three investment strategies: a small cap U.S. strategy, a SMID cap U.S. strategy, and SMID cap global strategy. Today, we're going to talk to Mr. Cook about the current market environment in light of what he's seen in his past 30 years as a portfolio manager. 2019 is the 30th anniversary of Southern Sun. Why is this important, and how is the firm different today from when it began?
Well, obviously, a lot of things have changed in the past 30 years. So I don't think there's any possible way we could have ever been the same as we were when we began. Obviously, those days were one person in a broom closet. So quite different in that respect. You know, I think the interesting piece is that the marketplace, in some sense, has changed in the past 30 years dramatically. And part of that is that really in the last decade or so, the introduction of different types of technology along with the types of vehicles to invest. And so I think the most important piece for us has always been that we are adaptable. And I think that our understanding of history is important because, unfortunately, we humans as well as machines tend to underestimate the significance of long history or earlier ages. And we tend to overweight the potential of more recent history. In some circle, that's called recency bias. And I think that we're all prone to that, as well as the machines that we make. And I think that that presents, in every generation along the way, presents unique problems. I think that for us, you know, it's interesting because when I first began, one of the things that I tried to communicate was people would want to know what was a reasonable time to judge a business. And I always used to say, you won't know if we're any good at this until we've done it for 50 years. Well, we've done it for 30 out of the 50 at this point. And I think that that still holds true. So I think the exciting piece is that 30 years on, we actually are looking, I think, at the vision for the next 50. So it's not about the next 20 necessarily as much as it is the next 50. And I think that part of that is that it brings about our approach has been adaptable. And so part of that adaptability allows us, I mean, we're in a sense have more of an open architecture, if you will, in modern terms, in that we're very happy to learn from whatever is occurring at the moment. But our philosophy and process is such that it allows that adaptability without actually changing the values and principles that go alongside of our approach. And there's a reliability, I think, over time that's created as a result of that, so that you can think about it in such a way as irrespective of what happens next, it's fundamentally the way we've approached buying businesses over the past 30 years, gives us a pretty good indication that that capacity to continue to do that and be successful at it is reasonably high. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be difficult periods, because we've had those as well. And I think, you know, to me, it's a little bit like our proclivity to say that what Stephen Hawking said is more important than what Newton had to say. And I'm not really sure that that binary thought process is helpful for us. And so the long past actually can inform what's next, not because what's next is going to be exactly like the past, because it will be different. But it can inform that as long as the past doesn't become sentiment.
Would you say that experience is important right now?
I mean, I think experience is probably always important. I think it's really important, though, to not confuse experience and wisdom. Because how one processes experience over time and in what framework one does that, I think will make all the difference in one's ability over time, like I was saying a second ago. I think it creates an environment that allows one to adapt while at the same time utilizing principles and an overarching backdrop of a philosophy that will work irrespective of the environment that you're in. Unfortunately, that takes patience, and I think that's something that we're short on in this day and age. We kind of think everything's going to happen fast. And a lot of it does. And thank goodness for the technology, because there's amazing things that are coming out of that, and people's lives will be changed for the better because of it. But I do think that it creates an environment where there's an expectation that everything's going to happen quickly and the same as it has in perpetuity in the most recent past. So I think that patience is something that is lacking, and certainly understandable why people are constantly wanting to change in order to create a better opportunity. But frankly, more times than not, there's a real advantage to having had enough experience to know when to press forward and when to back off. And I think that that's been a benefit 30 years.
How would you describe what is happening in the market today, and how does the current environment compare to other periods?
Well, again, nothing ever happens the same way twice, but there are similarities. And I think that what has been interesting, it has been the length of time, at least up until last year, where volatility remained so low in the marketplace. I think that, coupled with global financial system that frankly has seen unprecedented liquidity as we came out of the global financial crisis. I think that liquidity has created an environment that is like other environments before, but probably to an extended degree, where scale is really the only option, because the reinvestment rates have been so low. So the focus becomes one of top line as opposed to bottom line. And these sorts of things reverse themselves in time. And I think it is important to remember that innovation tends to come in clusters. And so what happens is we tend to have these periods of time where that innovation drives a lot of creativity and a lot of optionality, but in the end, very little of it remains economically viable over a longer period of time. So we typically have a little bit of a washing out period after you have these high levels of innovation. And they usually do occur when monetary policy and money is easy. So I think that probably is very much in structure similar to other periods. It's clearly very different because we've never seen an easing of the monetary system globally for this length of time. So I do think that there are some unique pieces of this, but there certainly are also, I think, a lot of similarities. The fact that we have disruptions, they can be of any sort. They can be technological, they can be trade barriers, they can be tariff dynamics, they can be Brexit, They can be, political instability. And I think all of those things actually really are very similar in that they're disruptive and create a higher level of anxiety and uncertainty in the marketplace. And frankly, we kind of needed to get to this place eventually, whether it was 2 years ago that we got to it or whether it's today, we kind of needed to get to this place in order for our approach to really have more fertile ground for opportunity, because we kind of count on the marketplace being disrupted for a reasonable period of time. I think we saw some cracks in February last year. They were very brief. Then the market sort of returned itself to, and this is not dissimilar to what we saw, post the 1997 Asian financial crisis, as well as the sort of the dot-com bubble, if you will, although there were other things around that that I think were as equally important. But it's not dissimilar in the sense that there's a fissure in the marketplace, then the marketplace wants to sort of hold on to what it's been doing for the past 3 or 4 years. And then again, last autumn and winter into December, we saw the marketplace even take a larger, more volatile opening up of the earth, if you will, using the earthquake analogy there. And there's no way for us to know whether this is the big break or the beginning of the big break. Obviously, the bounce in January probably has made some people rethink that, but the likelihood is that we'll need to see some substantive transition from what is a low volatility market to a much higher volatility market. And in that transition, fundamentals of specific businesses will begin to matter, whereas it's really been marketplaces as a whole that people have been wagering on.
We saw market volatility increase in 2018. How was last year's sell-off similar to or different than 2008?
2018 was probably similar to not only 2008, but other periods where the market sells off dramatically, and that would be such as in the 2000 market crack when the tech bubble burst. And I think it's similar in that fear tends to drive investment when people are worried about, as I said a minute ago, a large number of what they consider to be normally certainties that become uncertainties. There tends to be also, in a similar vein, there tends to be an overreaction, I think, in the marketplace, and the difference would be in 2008, I think people began to price virtually all businesses as if they were going out of business. Whereas in this last cycle, it's clearly been certain businesses that have been priced in the same way. The difference in the volatilities, frankly, is one is substantially more advantageous to us long term. And in 2008, as you look at it compared to 2018, for us, it was not so much about positioning ourselves into new businesses as, in some way it is now for us, as much as understanding the progress and the prospects of the businesses that we currently own in the portfolio. And I think that the strength of the fundamentals of our businesses today are substantially overlooked. Very similar, but for a different reason than they were in 2008. I think the reasons are more similar to what we saw in 1999 and 2000, than coming out of that dot-com bubble burst. I think they're more similar, but they're certainly not exactly the same. And that is that industrial businesses, the industrial complex, clearly beginning in 2013 and into 2014, was just perceived to be a place that was going away. I think it's remarkably interesting that with the high degree of confidence that the market is placing in sort of the new business model, the technologically driven business model, the AI-driven business model, that there's this massive leap that the market takes to traditional businesses, ergo, will not exist anymore. When in reality, many traditional businesses are probably in a position to take the greatest opportunity from technological developments because they actually can implement them in such a way that they filter in to the broad global economy. And I think that that one element alone, obviously coupled with a whole host of other things, that element alone is reason for us to be extremely hopeful coming out of this period, just like we were in 2000, 2001, 2002, and then onward, as well as 2009 and 10. And that is, there's not this necessary binary outcome. Frankly, most of our businesses are utilizing technology in ways that they never have before. And some on one side of this would probably argue that it's because they're panicking and they're worried that their space is going to be completely littered and covered up by the more new, lean, technologically savvy businesses. When in reality, that economy itself, the tech economy, has really low barriers to entry. It's basically about talent. And so I don't think that the products are necessarily going to stop being created. People aren't going to stop farming. They're not going to stop shipping things. They may do it in a different way, but manufacturing is going to have to continue in some way, shape, or form. So traditional businesses have historically, and I think they will continue to, implement developments in technology. And frankly, as the marketplace discounts those businesses as if they were not going to exist into the future, as opposed to recognizing the benefits that they're going to accrue in the years to come because of the innovation and the disruption that's currently. I think that's where our opportunity set is. And I think it's important to remember when we enter these periods of high volatility, and in particular where we see market sell-offs of some significance, it's a real mistake to presume that just because volatility has returned, that we're going to get an immediate benefit from that. That too can take some time. Yes, there's a possibility that you get a quick upturn and people shift their attention into more traditional businesses for fundamental reasons. That can happen. But generally, this is a more progressive thing and takes a little bit of time. And I think that the marketplace itself will go through some heaving, if you will, in probably, you know, the next 12 months, because all the uncertainties aren't going to be cleared up overnight. I think that one of the main issues that's different is today there's expectation of recession. Back then, it was because of the financial instruments that were involved, in particular those that were related to home mortgages. It was pretty much a given that we were going to go into a financial recession. I think that at this point, The marketplace is seeing that is going to occur at some point, but certainly doesn't have as high a degree of confidence as it did back then. I would also say that because of the industrial recession over 2014 and 2015, and because of the positioning historically and currently of our portfolio, many of our businesses have actually already seen a recession. So while it isn't one from a necessarily a more traditional overall economic recession, it certainly was in the commodity complex and in the manufacturing complex and the industrial complex in such a way that they actually have retooled and refitted their business models from that period of lower commodity prices, of more investment into higher technology as opposed to traditional businesses.
How are you taking advantage of the recent market sell-off? Do you think we've reached a bottom?
Yeah, to the first question, as we've discussed, volatility does offer opportunity, but it's not something that happens all at one time and all in one place. So there is it's a window, and we would prefer if that volatility continued for a period of time, because it's going to offer us the most opportunities. I also think that it's really intellectually dishonest to argue that market prices falling necessarily mean that valuations are becoming more attractive. There can be correlations between those. And so I think that typically that volatility is going to impact a larger swath of businesses. And so there needs to be distinction one business from the next. And so how we're taking advantage of that is that we actually, because we are, our approach is one that puts us right kind of in the primary fundamental line of understanding how a business operates, what their opportunities are, and what their value proposition is. And because we're in the weeds, if you will, we have a better perspective, I think, over time when it comes to distinguishing between whether it's a marketplace issue as a whole or whether there's something fundamentally that is actually at issue with a particular business. Our businesses, a number of our businesses have been out of favor for a number of years, and yet they've continued to execute. So our view would be that, one, we're certainly seeing opportunities to invest more in the businesses that we own, but we're also, because of the market finally kind of taking a breather or actually coming to, an abrupt halt. We'll see in time whether that's, which one of those it is. As a result of that, as has been in the past, it opens up windows of opportunity for us to distinguish strong fundamentally disciplined businesses and business leaders, as opposed to the market as a whole being either positive or negative.
A question that I suppose you get all the time is, in what environment are you going to outperform?
Yeah, and I think the challenge with that particular question that we do get asked is frankly, we're not necessarily looking at relative outperformance. You know, our firm DNA is really to own and back businesses that aren't fashionable. We do things that aren't in vogue, and we have for the past 30 years, and I expect we will for the next 50. And I think that that's the vision we had in the beginning, and I think it's the vision that carries forward, and it's the substance that sort of underlines our opportunity set, irrespective of how difficult an environment might have been. And I think that we need to make that distinction between relative outperformance and absolute performance. And I think that that goes back to that whole issue of patience and having really the constitution to be able to think about absolutely strong performance of businesses over time, as opposed to thinking more about its relative relationship to marketplaces in general. I mean, the fact of the matter is we don't try to set a portfolio up so that we're a relatively top performing firm. The notion is that when that does happen, and it has happened, not because we set it up that way, you're also going to have periods of disappointment from a relative perspective as well. So I think that the focus for us has to be that we remain circumspect, that our focus is on putting a portfolio of businesses together that can outperform inflation by 10 to 12, 13% over time. And frankly, we think that that presents itself in such a way, and I think that our history probably is a small indication, certainly not all of it, because again, I think that you need lots of time. I think it's, you know, centuries, potentially not as small as we'd like. And I think that there is a, you know, certainly an opportunity for us in this environment that is very unique. Even though, I mean, we certainly have been on the front line of saying that valuations have been better for us for the last 2 years. And so it goes back to the notion that just because that occurs, it doesn't necessarily mean that the performance is going to, you know, come in a big wave, because we're not trying to position it for the near term. We're trying to position it for the long term. And I think that that's the challenge that most people face, is having the constitution, if you will, to think in 10, 12, 15, 20-year periods of time.
How do you feel about the valuations of your current portfolio, and how are you managing it?
I think importantly, first and foremostly, we're finding high-quality businesses at significant discounts at this point in time. So we think the valuations are very compelling. That said, when the gap between that discount and their potential value, the timing in that is always uncertain. Yet at the same time, I think that valuation gap has a higher potential of closing that gap when the quality and the fundamentals of the business, as we look at, as they continue to execute. And I would say that that's the biggest key, is the level of execution and the quality of the businesses suggest to us that, and have, that we, once we had a point in time where the marketplace as a whole began to show some fear, then the opportunity set was going to be elevated for us, where valuations are substantially more compelling because there will be some distinction at some point based on quality.
Well, Mr. Cook, I really appreciate your time. Thank you. This has been great.
Thank you as well. And I look forward to us having more of these conversations as the year unfolds.